Hello, this is Terrence McNally. With the retirement of Justice Kennedy and the looming fight to hold back the confirmation of a replacement until after the midterms, which would increase voter turnout on both sides, let's listen to my 2013 conversation with Marcia Coyle regarding her book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. And I believe Coyle confirms my contention that the most crucial issue in considering GOP-nominated justices is not abortion or gun control, but the rights and powers of corporations versus those of human beings. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum. A friend tells the story of striking up a conversation with a well-dressed man in his late 20s, early 30s, in a movie line on the west side of L.A. shortly before the 2004 election between George W. Bush and John Kerry. He asked the young man who he planned to vote for, to which the fellow replied, he hadn't made up his mind. My friend said to him two words, Supreme Court, to which the young man replied, oh, are we voting for them too that day? Now, while we may be disappointed in his apparent lack of civics knowledge, in his own way, he spoke the truth. The most lasting actions a president takes may be his appointments to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court justices serve for as long as they wish or as long as they're able, and their decisions often set precedents that can last forever, if you will. Bush had appointed John Roberts Chief Justice in his first term, but according to today's guest, it was the second term appointment of Samuel Alito to replace Sandra Day O'Connor that really solidified the Roberts Court. O'Connor had been a much more moderate conservative than Alito has proven to be. The center of the court shifted to the right, which may matter little in decisions with large majorities. More than 50% of cases each term are decided unanimously or by 8-1 or 7-2 votes, but can be crucial in decisions that are decided 5-4. Marcia Coyle has chosen to focus her book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution, on four such 5-4 decisions. Citizens United on campaign finance, District of Columbia versus Heller on gun control, decision on race in schools in Seattle and Louisville, and finally on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. We're going to talk about those decisions, as well as some from the just completed term, including decisions on voting rights, affirmative action, and gay marriage. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I believe have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Marcia Coyle is the chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. A lawyer and journalist, Coyle has covered the Supreme Court for 25 years. She regularly appears on PBS's NewsHour. Her work has earned numerous national journalism awards, including the George Polk Award for Legal Reporting, the Investigative Reporters and Editors Award for Outstanding Investigative Reporting, the Scripps Howard Foundation Award for Environmental Reporting, and the American Judicature Society's Tony House Journalism Award. She is the author of her first book, the just published, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Welcome to Free Forum, Marcia Coyle.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
Very good. I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you tell us, in your own words, a bit about your path to the work that you do today? And feel free to go way back and mention mentors or turning points or moments of decision.
Well, actually, I've been more of a journalist than a lawyer in my life. I started my career on my hometown newspaper writing obituaries. I was hired by an editor who thought I was overqualified for the job, but I wanted so desperately to work, and it was hard without any real experience to find a newspaper job, even though I had a master's in journalism. But I took it and was fortunate enough that I struck up a conversation via the telephone with the newspaper's correspondent in the state capital of Pennsylvania, Harrisburg. And when the newspaper started talking about expanding its statehouse coverage, I very brazenly went into the publisher and sat down and told him why I thought I was the best person to do it. And lo and behold, I got the job. They got me very cheaply, I would say. Probably that's why I got the job. But I really grew up as a reporter in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, covering state government, state politics, traveled all over the state during elections. I like to say I knew former Attorney General Dick Thornburgh before he became Attorney General. I covered him when he ran for governor of Pennsylvania, and I was there during the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. I also traveled with Arlen Specter, the late U.S. Senator, so I knew him before he actually went to Washington. But I stayed in Harrisburg a good long time, and I started getting a little bored, and I didn't know if I was bored with Harrisburg or covering state politics, and I think it was probably Harrisburg, which wasn't known as the most exciting city in Pennsylvania. But I woke up one day and I said, gee, you got to do something. If you find yourself hating your job, what else would you like to do? And I thought, well, you know, when I was in college, I was very interested in law. And covering Pennsylvania, I covered Pennsylvania courts as well as politics. So I thought I'd go to law school. And you'll be appalled at how I decided which law school to pick.
Okay.
I knew I had to work full time. So I got a map out and looked at what were the night law schools. There was one in Philadelphia, and that was going to be a two-hour train ride. And then there were two in Baltimore, Maryland. That was going to be an hour and a half drive from Harrisburg. So I thought, well, it's got to be Baltimore then. It's shorter. And then I looked at where those two law schools in Baltimore were. There was one right off of Interstate 83 South, and there was one in downtown Baltimore. So I picked the one right off Interstate 83 South and applied and got in. And it took me about 4 years of going nights, and I think my gas taxes paid for much of Interstate 83 between Baltimore and York, Pennsylvania. But it worked out well. I worked in Harrisburg with a great group of reporters from all around the state. And often, if I came in from classes at about 11 o'clock at night, I'd have to go right back to the state capitol to cover their endless budget or abortion debates. And the guys in the press room would have covered for me and brought me up to speed, and they were just terrific. So when I was halfway through law school, my newspaper at the time decided to open a Washington bureau, and they thought since I was already halfway to Washington, going to law school every night, that I should do that, and so I did. I opened the Allentown Morning Call's first Washington bureau and covered primarily the Pennsylvania congressional delegation, and then also any Supreme Court cases that involved Pennsylvania. After about 4 years, when I finished law school, I thought I wanted to combine the two, and the National Law Journal had a bureau two floors above my bureau in the National Press Building. So I went up there one day, knocked on the door. And I've been really lucky, Terrence, let me tell you, in my career. I have to tell you, they had just lost a reporter.
Oh.
And I applied for the job, got the job, and then the bureau chief left to go to the L.A. Times, and he covered the Supreme Court. And no one else in the bureau wanted the Supreme Court beat, and I can tell you why, but I did. I wanted it desperately and got it. And the rest, as they say, is history.
But it's 25 years of history. I mean, it's...
That's right, it is. It's a very strange beat for reporters because it's a lot of reading.
Yeah.
And little contact with your main sources of information.
That's right. You don't get those press briefings every day and that sort of thing.
Right.
You the people that you are covering most closely, you have never had as much contact with as you did in preparing for this book.
Oh, absolutely. That's so true. And I was very fortunate that the justices did give me access, and I like to think it's because through my coverage of the court for the National Law Journal and when I talk about the court on PBS's The NewsHour, I try to be very even-handed, and I'm sort of old-fashioned in terms of journalism. I've always believed that you try to give people as much information as you can possibly give them, and then let them make up their minds whether you know they like what the court did or they don't like what the court did. And I think the justices saw the even-handedness, and that's why they opened their doors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know, when you took on the book, you didn't know that you'd necessarily get that sort of access, right?
No, I didn't at all. I really didn't. And I was very gratified that I did get it. And one or two turned me down.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't too surprised about that either. I mean, some of them are very, very cautious about what they say. And also, I was surprised they aren't really familiar with ground rules that other public officials are. I with one in particular, I remember I was told, well, the interview has to be off the record. And when I went into the interview, I said to the justice, you know, to me, off the record means I can't use anything you say unless I can find some other party to say the same thing. And that's not going to happen. I said, what about on background? If we talk on background, I can use what you say, but I can't name
attribute
you.
It, yeah.
And this justice was like, oh, well, that's what I meant, on background, but thought that's what off the record meant.
You know, it's kind of interesting when you point that out, and I can tell in your chuckle that you find the same thing. In other words, here are gentlemen and women who are, you know, everything about their work is precision and I's dotted and T's crossed, and that something as basic as that wouldn't have been within their knowledge.
Right, exactly. I also tell you, my love for the Supreme Court really goes back to when I was a journalism student at Northwestern and working on my master's there. I spent my winter in Washington, D.C., in their program they had where they used graduate students as reporters for newspapers around the country that didn't have Washington reporters. And my beat at the time was the Supreme Court. I remember at the end of that session, that winter session, there was this crusty old retired journalist who ran the program. And he said to me as I was leaving, well, do you think you're ever going to come back to Washington? And I said, I am, and I'm going to come back and cover the Supreme Court.
Wow.
It was always in the back of my mind, and it took me 9 years to get there, but I got there.
That's interesting. I must say that I asked that first question of almost all my guests, and so many of them who have done, are doing very important things, say that their path was widely accidental. You know, and it sounds like you, while you say you were lucky, had this vision in the back of your mind, and here we are talking about how well you've achieved it. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Marcia Coyle. She's chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal and the author of her first book, The Roberts Court: The Struggle for the Constitution. How did the book happen?
Oh, you won't believe this. I am so lucky. I had two extraordinary emails in the summer of 2010 during my coverage of the Senate confirmation hearings for Elena Kagan, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The first email was from an editor at Simon & Schuster asking me if I would be interested in writing a book about the court. And then the second one was actually a marriage proposal from a viewer. my second marriage proposal. My first one I accepted.
Okay.
I am married. But the editor from Simon & Schuster just said, you know, she was interested in any ideas I had for a book about the court. So I said I was a little busy, but when I finished with the hearings, you know, I would get back to her. And in the interim, I thought of some ideas and called her one day and gave her about four ideas, which she, in about 30 seconds, knocked down completely and told me that she had something in mind.
Uh-huh.
And would I come up to New York and meet with her and the publisher of Simon & Schuster, which I did. And in the meantime, I was thinking about her idea, which was she wanted to look at the Roberts Court, the current court, through the lens of, say, three major decisions by that court. So when I got to New York, and sat down with them, I had thought through how I thought it might be done, what cases I thought would draw people through, at that point, the 7 years of the Roberts Court. And in about 30 minutes, the publisher said, "Well, I'm sold. Let's do it." And that was it.
Wow.
I didn't have to write a book proposal. And this editor, believe it or not, is the same editor who edited All the President's Men, The Brethren, and she continues today to be Washington Post Bob Woodward's editor. She edited the Jobs biography that came out.
Yeah.
She is just, she's a legend. And
Alice Mayhew, right?
Yes, yeah. You got it. Yeah. I said, I've never written a book. And she said, "I'm not worried about that. I'm here for any questions you have. I've watched you on TV. I've read your articles. And I know how you think." And that was it. So, again, I was incredibly fortunate to get an editor like her. And I was off and running.
Well, let me just ask then, since we'll get into all that other stuff I promised up front, but having covered the Supreme Court for 25 years, having been a journalist for basically all of your adult life, what was the shift like? What were the challenges? What surprised you most? What was most difficult? That sort of thing about shifting to a book.
I agreed to do the book primarily because I've been concerned in the last few years that the reason I went to the National Law Journal and the kind of journalist I wanted to become, that it was disappearing. We've all become in this business today daily reporters. And the National Law Journal is a weekly newspaper. And when I first joined the Law Journal, I was told, "You have to learn everything possible about your subject before you put it down on paper. The law is complicated. You've got readers who are sophisticated. And if you're going to write a front-page story for the Law Journal, we're going to give you about 3 weeks to do it." But now we're writing daily, hourly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blogging. I'm writing for the web. I'm doing video. I'm doing radio. So I was concerned I was becoming superficial, to be honest with you, and I wanted to be able to see if I could once again really dig into a subject and write in depth about it and comprehensively about it. And that's really why I took on the book. And it was writing a book is really hard. It's very isolating in a sense, but I had a subject that I loved, and I felt the structure of the book would carry me through. The hardest thing, I think, was actually interviewing the justices, preparing for those interviews, and trying to structure questions in a way that you could get the most information from people who really didn't want to talk about what goes on inside the court. They're very protective of each other, and that was the hardest thing, coming up with questions that they would be willing to answer. So I would give it an awful lot of thought before I went into those interviews. And then I guess the surprising thing was, one, that they were more willing than I thought to talk about court and their relationships with each other, and that they really do like each other. This is a very collegial court, and they care very much about how the court is viewed by the public. So I think that was most surprising. The most fun part, I'll tell you, though, was I tell the stories of how these four cases got to the Supreme Court, and the fun part was meeting and talking with the people behind the cases.
Yes, let me cut in for 1 second, Marcia Coyle. It seems to me that is where you were outside of your normal beat. Am I correct?
Yes, for the most part, yes. We don't do too much. I mean, usually before, say, the argument in a big case, you'll see the reporters who cover the court do a background feature on the people and all that, people and the lawyers who are handling the case. But I was really able to not only talk to the people who were involved in the case, but also to get the lawyers involved in the case to tell me about their strategy, which I found fascinating and I think really gives great insight to all readers as to how some of these cases get to the court. All four cases that I focus on really were cases from their very beginning were aiming for the U.S. Supreme Court and had behind them very smart conservative lawyers who perhaps this was an agenda kind of issue for them. I think for three of the four it was. And really structured their cases to move, if they could, as fast as they could through the right lower courts to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think that's what sets this book apart from other books about the court, because I not only show how they got to the court, then what happens when they do get to the court.
Right. In other words, it seemed to me, I agree with you, by the way, that I do think that thing about the strategic, long-term planning of the lawyers in each of these four cases, and my guess is in a lot of other cases over the last few years,
sure,
as part of a broad conservative or right strategy, is something that, I mean, in a way, the title, The Roberts Court, the subtitle, The Struggle for the Constitution, doesn't tell you that actually what the, as I say, what may be the most original in terms of people getting an insight into it and getting to watch it take place and some of it in hindsight, but they're also telling you what their foresight was, is that it's really about that backstory of the strategic, consistent efforts to change the law or keep the law as it is by aiming from the very start, from, as you say, the choice of the plaintiff, the choice of, you know, where the venue, everything is done. There's a game plan aimed for the Supreme Court and to take advantage, if you will, of the current makeup of the court. Before you comment on that, let me tell people again, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Marcia Coyle. She's chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal, and we're talking about her first book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Any thoughts about what I just said? Because
yes,
I do think it is
absolutely.
It's almost like if I don't know whether Alice Mayhew would have said, that's the book I want about that strategy. But it almost seems to me that the book could have another title and another subtitle and just shift the figure and ground slightly, if you get where I'm going.
Oh, I do, absolutely. And I think she really liked how it turned out because it wasn't an aspect of the book that she had envisioned at first. When I did meet with the publisher and Alice and told them the cases I wanted to focus on, you know, I explained why I picked those cases. One of the reasons was that they all had behind them these smart conservative lawyers aiming for the court. They also were 5-4 decisions, and I picked those because I think that's what we learn, where we learn the most about the individual justices. But you're absolutely right about the strategizing here. In the Second Amendment gun case, for example, the lawyers spent a lot of time finding the most sympathetic plaintiffs to bring this original lawsuit. They interviewed people. They put out messages. They advertised and tried to really find the best clients. And in the healthcare case, the Republican state attorney general from Florida, who took the lead in that case, instead of filing the original challenge to Obamacare in the federal district court that was just down the street from his office in Tallahassee, they picked a court that was 250 miles away in Florida because it had all Republican district court judges. It didn't have a heavy criminal load, caseload, so they knew that if it did have a heavy criminal caseload, their lawsuit could get bogged down since those cases are given priority. So they found the court, Republican judges, big civil caseload would move quickly. There's just a lot of smart litigation strategy behind these cases.
Yeah, I want to go with along that track, but first I want to just set up one question because I don't want to get to the end and have left it out. You have said that I've watched interviews and I've seen things commenting on the book and so on, and you've said sort of as a bottom line, I don't think they're partisan. I don't think they have an axe to grind. We're talking about the justices, the Supreme Court justices. I think they try hard to get it right. Do you think that sort of assessment applies to Bush v. Gore?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. I think that decision is probably more political than any decision I've seen in the years that I've covered the court. I think they abandoned, at least the five conservatives, really did abandon conservative principles in deciding that case. When I say, I think asking whether it's politics or law to me is one of the hardest questions to answer, and everybody asks that question about the closely divided cases. And what I add to what you just said, I say about the justices, is that, you know, one, we'd be really naive to think that they approach these cases like blank slates. They don't. And they're on the Supreme Court because they were appointed by a president who, you know, may not have known how the justice was going to vote in every case, but assumed they had philosophies, ideologies that were in line with the appointing presidents. So I think each justice brings to these cases his or her own experiences in life and in the law, and they try to check their biases at the door. And there are certain court doctrines that do help them to do that, like stare decisis, respect for prior decisions, deference to Congress when they're looking at a law that Congress enacted. But some of them, you know, believe in those doctrines more than others. Someone like Justice Clarence Thomas has, you know, no time for stare decisis. If he thinks a precedent is wrong, it's wrong. And if it's going to upset years of practices by police or citizens, too bad. If it's wrong, it's gone. So, it's just a really hard question, Terrence.
But let me ask you again, because I'm sure you, at the time, covered it in depth and have thought about it, and I will even throw in, did you bring it up, that particular decision, in your conversations with any of the justices? But give me a little more. I mean, I heard you say, I think they abandoned their apolitical principles. I think a little bit more, if you could flesh out for your take on that decision. And my question, I will ask, did you bring it up with any of them in working on this book, or did you stick to the four decisions you focused on?
Yeah, I did not bring up Bush v. Gore with them. I mean, a number of the justices who were involved in that are no longer on
right.
The court. And I did want to focus just on the Roberts Court, so I didn't bring it up. As far as there were things in Bush v. Gore that, you know, I could see in cases like Citizens United, the campaign finance
case. Yes.
A lack of deference to duly elected officials who are accountable to the public. Not allowing, stepping into an issue, when it could be resolved by the lower courts or the state legislature. To me, I say in my book that the Roberts Court justices, conservatives, sometimes act in unconservative ways. And I think that was evident in Bush v. Gore. There was time. Bush v. Gore and the dispute in Florida was embarrassing to a certain extent because we didn't know who was going to be president, but it could have been worked out. And that was the difference between the majority and the dissent in Bush v. Gore. There was a vote of 7-2 that there had been an equal protection violation here in how the votes were counted. But the real difference was the dissenters felt that you could send it back to the Florida Supreme Court and with instructions, and they could work it out. The majority did not want to do that. It was a very bold, aggressive act.
Well, as even the fact that they took the action on a Sunday as if irreparable harm could be done to the nation if that vote, if that recount went on.
Exactly. And, you know, this nation has withstood other crises. This is not going to bring down the government by any means.
And of course, in the way we have our system set up, we have a sitting president.
That's right.
In other words, you know, we had another month to go before there was even an issue of that.
This is Terrence McNally. With Trump about to announce his next pick for the Supreme Court, you're listening to my 2013 conversation with Marcia Coyle, author of The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution.
Okay, let's move on. I want to ask a few of those big basic questions. I've seen you say that we're going to talk about the Constitution a bit. The Constitution, you say, provides some specifics, such as the age 35 to be president. But on other issues, it's fairly vague. Freedom of speech, unreasonable search and seizure, those sorts of terms leave a lot of room for interpretation. My question is, and I'm asking you to do what I guess Thomas and Scalia ask us all to do, which is put ourselves in the minds of the founders. One way that they could have been approaching it is to set up a set of principles that can be applied as conditions change. So the application of a sort of broad set of principles would be set up to be adapted. The other would be that they are setting out terms that spell out a vision under conditions current when it was written, with the assumption that it would have to be adapted as conditions change by amendments and that sort of thing. We have amendments, but we have very few, and we haven't had any in quite a long time. How, then, do we adapt that document to the current conditions as they have changed?
Well, are you asking me as how the justices approach it?
Approach it and how you see it, having looked at it actually perhaps longer than they have?
I think their experience goes well beyond mine, to be honest with you. But
25 years would have put Alito and Roberts at fairly young folks.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But they were solely they also were judges.
I know.
And were okay. But you really have identified basically two different approaches, and they are reflected very much on the Roberts Court. And I would think someone like Justice Breyer, for example, would say that the document sets out these principles and you apply the principles to changing conditions. They're not saying it's a living constitution, which Justice Scalia likes to refer to very derisively.
Right, it's a good straw man.
Yes, absolutely. The principles underlying the Constitution don't change, Justice Breyer would say, but the conditions to which they apply do. And I think Justice Kagan said very much the same thing during her confirmation hearings, whereas Justices Scalia and Thomas, for example, do believe you look at the original public meaning of the terms to see if the condition being looked at today, whether the original public meaning of the terms of the Constitution dictate, you know, how they should decide. And it's really a very fascinating argument as to which interpretation gives more discretion to a judge or more power to a judge. Justice Breyer thinks that, you know, relying on the original public meaning makes a judge all-powerful, because who really knows what the original public meaning was? And yet Justice Scalia, who, you know, really likes to have rules, he, you know, feels that giving, looking at principles and applying them to current conditions is open-ended discretion and makes the judge too powerful. So it's a fascinating debate, and the two of them have really gone at it over the years, even in public discussions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, I think personally, I think relying on original public meaning is just something of a dead end. I think that you do have to sort of understand the principles underlying the Constitution and the vision that it encompasses, and then you know, apply it to current or changing conditions, because you know, we don't want the Constitution to become a dead letter. It has to be able to be applied to current conditions in order to remain a relevant document in our lives.
Yes, and as we both sort of alluded to, how it's impossible to know what was in their minds, but if one could step back even from the Constitution and look at what I imagine the principles of those founders to be, they were revolutionaries. They were creatures of a fairly new enlightenment, which makes revolution even more than, you know, to have a revolution where the system changes, but the worldview doesn't, is one thing. But their revolution almost was a change of worldview. And to think that they would have written the document and said, that people of that personality and that approach to thought and action would have said, we're making a document that we want you to abide by to the letter for 200, 300 years, seems completely not who those people were.
Oh, absolutely. You had asked me earlier, you know, what were some of the surprising things I found when I was doing the book, and it was in my interview with Justice Scalia, I was surprised about his view of historians. He felt, and it is true in a number of cases, in the gun cases, a good example, you had competing historians' views of the Second Amendment. But he said to me that, one, that historians can be as causy as anyone else, and he felt fully competent to examine the history and come to the right conclusion, which I really think is kind of amazing. I mean, we have historians in this country who have spent their lives studying particular periods in our history, and to think that, you know, in the course of one Supreme Court case, you can study all about the history prior to, during, and even after, say, the enactment of the Second Amendment, which on your own is to me pretty amazing. He's a very confident judge.
Yes, I think amazing stands in for arrogant, perhaps. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent for the National Law Journal. We're talking about the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and some of the ideas and issues in her first book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. I'm going to jump to another question that has to do with the founders and what's happened since the founders. I interviewed Tim DeChristopher recently. I'm not sure if you know who he is, but he's the young man who bid on parcels at a public lands auction in Utah and won the parcels but had no intention of buying them, didn't have the cash to buy them, and he did it to, if you will, monkey wrench the auction, which later, when Obama was elected and Ken Salazar became Secretary of the Interior, was disallowed anyway because there hadn't been the proper procedures done before that auction.
Okay.
So he commits an act of civil disobedience, and he is offered plea deals, and he refuses the plea deals because he has a belief in the sort of the sanctity of a jury trial, that if he goes before a jury of his peers and they know what the situation was, that the auction was thrown out, that there was a selective prosecution, et cetera, one could argue relative evil, et cetera, that would be the right form. Well, it turns out when he finally goes to court that selective prosecution is inadmissible by the judge. Choice between two evils, information about that the auction was later invalidated. All these things are inadmissible, and in fact, the judge asks each of the jurors, each of the prospective jurors, are you willing to follow my instructions, even if doing so goes against your own moral judgment? And they all say yes, and they're allowed, and anyone who says no is disallowed. He says, is that what the founders intended? Now, I'm not asking about the Supreme Court, but you've been doing law all your journalistic life. Bit of research I've done, basically, our justice system doesn't have the capacity to handle the jury trials that would actually show up if a lot of people went to jury trials, so that the system basically works against jury trials, wants settlements, and then in its instructions and admissibility of evidence, the jury has lost a lot of its original power. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, jury trials are all but disappearing in this country. And I think it's partly because prosecutors are rather overwhelmed with handling criminal cases, and the plea bargaining system just becomes a much more efficient way of dealing with the cases they have. I think I can relate it to the Supreme Court. You know, one of the things that Justice Scalia, for example, is proudest of are the decisions that he has led on the court that tries to reinvigorate the role of the jury in our criminal justice system. The court, in divided decisions, has been directing that it is the role of the jury to decide facts, and has taken away certain powers from a judge to make those decisions. It often happens in the context of sentencing, but now it's even, the court has said, if the prosecutor charges something in an indictment that involves facts, it has to be determined by a jury, not a judge. So they have been trying to reinvigorate the role of juries in this country. A little bit of what you were also talking about is a very controversial topic of jury nullification.
Mm-hmm.
You know, should juries ignore what the judge's instructions are, and even perhaps what the law is, if they feel that sort of the gut right decision goes against
that they serve the greater public good, the greater good of society by taking that action.
Right. Now that's very controversial, because if that were widespread, you know, it could really undermine the rule of law in this country. So I think your larger point, though, is that there's a real danger in what's happening around the country in our criminal justice system when so much emphasis is put on plea bargaining.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that DeChristopher pointed out, and it certainly makes sense to me, is that you basically know that if you refuse the plea bargain and are found guilty, that you will be punished for that. In other words, your sentence, if you go to jury and are found guilty, will be greater than if you agree to any bargain ahead of time.
Boy, I hope that's not the case. I would be surprised if that's why that's a you know widespread practice around the country.
Oh, interesting.
That shouldn't enter into it at all. The fact that you exercise your right to a jury trial and you lose a trial, that you're going to be punished even harsher.
I think one of the things where I didn't do a ton of research to find out whether he was right or not, but one thing that occurred to me that made it make sense was that what are they offering you in that bargain? In other words, they're offering you something. They're making a deal. They have a negotiating side that says, if you will forego the jury trial, we'll give you this. And, you know,
I see what you're saying.
There's
now
a logic there.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, because that is the risk then that the defendant is going to take, that going to trial, you know, could result in a greater sentence than what the prosecutor is offering you in a plea bargain. But, you know, that sentence is usually what's set out in the law. So I don't think you're being punished for choosing a jury trial.
Right. Yeah, even if it turns out even if the result is harsher, it's not actually punishment.
Exactly.
So I would have to put punishment in quotes. Okay, I'm speaking with Marcia Coyle. We're talking about the law, and we're talking about her book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Let's go back to that big underlying idea in your book, which is about the consistent and strategic work of conservative and libertarian lawyers to bring cases to this most conservative court that they hope will rule in their favor. Could you talk about this a little bit in more depth, including more broadly the Powell memo written by Lewis Powell before he was appointed to the court, and the work of the Federalist Society to populate lower courts with right-leaning judges? And I'm going to read a quote here. From you, I believe all four landmark Roberts Court decisions that you deal with had at their inception very smart and talented conservative or libertarian lawyers who, when necessary, handpicked, as you said before, the most sympathetic clients, strategized with the best courts in which to file, with an eye toward their ultimate target, an increasingly friendly and conservative Supreme Court, framed the winning arguments to aim at that. And then I'm going to another point that I found about the Federalist Society, which is that over 45,000 lawyers and law students are involved in the Federalist Society activities, and every single federal judge appointed by the two presidents Bush was either a member or approved by members of the society, including the four Supreme Court justices, Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito. So talk about what's going on there.
Well, what's going on is that I think conservatives have been much more dedicated and smarter than liberals in realizing how important the courts are in this country. Frustrated, perhaps, by not making progress in Congress or state legislatures, in political elections, they've turned to the courts in order to get their agenda items, and they've been very successful. The Powell memo, you're referring to Lewis Powell, who, before he became a justice of the Supreme Court, was at one point a president of the American Bar Association, and he wrote a memo that really laid out for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce how to begin to press their concerns in the federal courts. And today, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce may well be the most successful special interest group in the country when it comes to pressing and winning cases in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Reagan administration really was the first, President Reagan was the first to realize and emphasize judicial appointments and how important they could be to getting the conservative philosophy on the federal bench. And they really had it down to a science in the Justice Department in terms of looking for young potential judges. And that was part of their plan. They not only wanted conservative judges, they wanted young ones who could be on the bench for many years. And Ronald Reagan changed the profile of many of the federal courts in this country by appointing young conservative judges. President Bush, George W., he also continued along that path and certainly was extremely successful with his appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court with the Chief Justice and Justice Alito. And that may well be his greatest legacy during his two terms. So the liberals, on the other hand, and part of that whole movement, as you pointed out, was the Federalist Society.
Yes.
And Justice Scalia was very much a part of helping to develop the Federalist Society. They have grown. They're on campuses all around the country, so young conservatives are coming up through the ranks now. They are very much a part of the discussion today. There's been an attempt by liberals to match that. There's an organization called the American Constitution Society, which has been growing and tries to exercise similar influence. But Presidents Clinton and President Obama, they really hadn't focused on the courts.
I know.
And their choices of nominees for the Supreme Court, I guess there's a decision, well, certainly it's very hard to get anybody confirmed in the Senate today. And their appointments have been more moderate and have disappointed many of their liberal backers who would like to see young liberal judges of this, that could match the young conservatives that are on the Supreme Court.
And then when we talk about the various district courts of appeals and so on throughout the country, the Clinton administration and the Obama administration have been slow to nominate, slow to get confirmation, as if this, when you point to Bush and say this could be his most important legacy, it seems they've ignored that. I'll tell you what, I want to move to one other question, which may take the rest of our time, which is you really say that you say you don't think this is a partisan court. And as we talked about, that means they don't wake up in the morning and say, how do I serve my Republican, the fellow who appointed me, or the party of the fellow that appointed me, et cetera. But they do have their philosophies, their aptitudes,
right,
and so on. But it is my sense that rather than conservative politically, which might include social as well as fiscal and governmental issues, that this court is pro-business, pro-corporation, looking out less for the rights of individual citizens, whether as customers, as work, as employees, as voters, and some of the decisions which do not get as much publicity as guns, abortion, campaign finance, and so on. Arbitration. They ruled in this thing that they strengthened arbitration and withdrew, it seemed to me, weakened citizens' ability to sue. Generic drug makers cannot be sued if the original drug was okayed by the FDA. Co-worker harassment, a supervisor is now defined as someone who has the right to hire and fire you, whereas in large corporations, I would assume there are many people that I would consider to be supervisors who could harass while not being able to hire or fire, et cetera. Talk, if you will, about that. When I was watching the confirmation hearings of Roberts and Alito, all the focus, as I say, was on the hot issues of abortion, gun control, that sort of thing, whereas in fact, both of their records on business versus individual are pretty unanimous.
Yes, and I would agree with you. I actually did ask the justices about the pro-business Roberts Court, and it was very interesting, some of the reactions. One vehemently denied it, said that you can look at the business cases and find as many for business as against business. Another said to me, I never thought that was the case until I saw this study. There was a study done by a federal appellate judge, Richard Posner, and two political scientists that showed that the Roberts Court was more pro-business, slightly more pro-business than the Rehnquist court that preceded it. And then there was another justice who I thought had probably a more sophisticated reaction. First, this justice said, I think the court is more anti-big litigation, big lawsuits. And that generally means that business will win. Now, I think they're really two categories here. The anti-big litigation, let's say involving class actions, that cuts across the bench. So it's not just conservatives. It's also some hostility on the part of liberals. They think that big class actions, like the big Walmart case we had, that that is expensive, time-consuming, burdensome for the courts, and doesn't serve either side particularly well. And then there are the business cases that involve really smaller consumers and workers. There, the court almost always splits 5-4 between conservatives and liberals, with conservatives winning. Conservatives on the Roberts Court interpret our job bias, our job discrimination laws, narrowly. And there is, historically, the court has read Congress's intent in our job bias laws to say the court should be interpreting the laws more liberally to reach and root out discrimination in the workforce. But this court, this conservative majority, interprets them very narrowly. Also, they are really raising the bar in the area of arbitration. Just about every consumer relationship with business today involves a contract that has a mandatory arbitration clause. And this court is saying those arbitration clauses have to be interpreted as written. That's primarily the conservatives on the court now who are doing that. And they've eliminated the ability of consumers with small claims to band together and bring class actions in arbitration. And it's not even just consumers. We had a case this term involving merchants who were suing, who were trying to
American Express.
Band together against American Express because they felt American Express was violating antitrust laws in forcing them to pay certain fees and accept all of American Express's various credit cards. For an individual merchant to go into arbitration on an antitrust claim would have, antitrust is one of the most expensive claims to bring and win. Those merchants, that individual merchant never would have been able to do that alone. And they wanted to band together in a class in order to share expenses and bring the claim. And the court said no, because there was a class action waiver, class action ban in the arbitration agreement.
Yeah. And I think we've got to bring it to a close, Marcia. We're at the end of the hour. But
I will wrap up and say that I think you're right. I think this court is leaning more towards business and against consumers.
Yeah, and then if I will have the last word and say that I think Citizens United, which allows corporations to spend unlimited, fits that same pattern. So again, the book is The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Thank you, Marcia Coyle, and keep up the good work.
Pleasure.
Okay. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and 3 or 4 articles of background, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, and Stan Mizrahi in production, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.